Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money at
Menards. Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Joe Biden gave a speech today. Clearly, and this is I love Joe Biden. I voted for him, big fan of his. Was not my first choice, to be clear, but enthusiastic. And having him in the White House, he should have stayed in bed today. Should have stayed under the covers, got some chicken soup, something. Clearly had something going on, a little congestion, a little cough. Said he got it from the grandson, don't care. Should have taken the day off. He should get a day off, as every working person should get a day off, and with pay as well. But here's the thing, and you know, I've watched Joe over these last several months, and I'm happy with the policies. The country's moving in the right direction. Good stuff is happening. But he shouldn't be giving these speeches. This is something that he should never be given long prepared speeches. He should be out there doing what Joe does best. Look, he's not Obama, and he's not Clinton either. Obama wasn't even Clinton. Joe is best when he's being Uncle Joe, man. Make the occasional gaffe if you have to, but the poor reading, the squinting, the stumbling over words, all that does is give the haters stuff to focus on. This way they can ignore all the stuff, the good stuff that's going on, and focus on, look at him, he can't read. Yeah, he's an older guy. I get it. I squint too. I'm thrilled with where we're heading. We're going in a good direction. Job numbers out, an extra 210,000. Not what we were expecting, but it isn't a massive loss like we had last year. 6 million jobs created since January. That is a good record to run on. 4.2% unemployment. We're down there. We're moving in the right direction. Things are looking in the right direction. Reuters reported today, new orders for U.S. made goods, stuff we make here, folks, with that Made in America label that I love so much. Increase. Big increase. In fact, Reuters reported new orders for U.S. made goods increased more than expected in October, and business spending on equipment appeared to rebound after a decline in the third quarter. Things are moving in the right direction. Orders, they said, orders increased by 17% on a year-on-year basis. We're doing better than we did last year. Moving in the right direction. Growth. Growth in the U.S. service sector has reached new heights. In November, things are going in the right direction. Wages on that as well. They said in the service sector, this is the AP reported, growth in the service sector, where most Americans work, hit an all-time high in November, surpassing the previous record in October. People are working. Wages in the hospitality and leisure industry up over 10% on the year. It's good stuff. We're moving in the right direction. And what I think's happening, and this is what I'm hoping we're seeing, is I'm hoping we're experiencing a fundamental shift in our economy and a much needed shift back to a worker-focused, a family-focused, community-focused economy. Not one solely concerned on maximizing shareholder wealth, which is where we have been for the last 40 years. We've been in this place where we got to make the rich people richer, even if that means it makes the rest of us poorer. We've got to be standing with each other when things happen so that we all make our lives better. That whole thing, you know, when the rising tide lifting all boats, that hasn't been so these last 40 years. What's happened is the boats have gotten bigger. And when the tide goes up, it just crushes the little ones. The little ones, that's you and me. That's we, the working people of this country. So today when Bernie Sanders tweeted out his support of the miners that have been on strike for, it's got to be 9 months now, the strikers at Warrior Met Coal in Brookwood, Alabama. He tweeted, I stand in solidarity with miners at Warrior Met in Alabama fighting back courageously against Wall Street vultures who forced cuts to their wages and benefits. It is time we put the lives of working people ahead of shareholder profits. My sentiments, exactly what I have been saying for at least the last 16 years of doing this program. What's interesting to me, and again, it goes back to that Jay Gould quote, I could easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. Immediately and without fail, someone chimed in the comments, well, you know, workers have they're shareholders too, don't you know? You're hurting the workers who are shareholders because you know, they may have a 401k, they may have profit sharing, whatever, they may have something. Reality check, folks. And for the people who throw that out there, reality check. Come back to the real world where the rest of us live. The wealthiest 1% of this country, they own about 40% of all stocks. The richest 5%, they own about 70% of all stocks. You get to the 10% level, over 80%. That means the bottom 90% of us, virtually everyone listening to this program tonight, we only own about 19% of the shares of stock out there. That's it. About 19% of all stocks traded on U.S. markets. And the thing is, the closer to the bottom you are, the lower that number gets, to where if you're in the bottom 60%, you own about 2% of the stocks. So the vast majority of the working class owns virtually nothing in the stock market, has virtually no interest in what happens on Wall Street other than making the wealth gods happy. You know, if we make the wealth gods happy, if we pray to the profit monster, everything's going to be okay because they're going to take care of us because they're benevolent. They're wonderful. And because of them, we can exist. That's what we're told. So it drives me insane when you see this stuff. And it got me thinking about that argument. Well, you know, we own stock too. And I do. I'm not going to argue with a little some of it. I do own some of them. I've got a 401k. I've got some of that stuff. I've got pension, you know, the things that I hope are going to be there when I get older. But the reality is, only about 56% of workers in this country participate in those workplace retirement programs of any kind. So you're talking about almost half that don't. And when you look at the numbers, the median amount in those 401ks is about 24,000. The median, you know, is the balance, which represents the balance between the highs and the lows right there, the median. Most people have close to nothing. But 24,500, you can't retire on that. And in the old days, you spent 40 years working for a company. There was a defined benefit pension, which have been all but eviscerated in this hope that, and this training that's gone on in this country. And this is the thing that's really infuriating, because they want us all to believe, you know, we're going to all be millionaires. We're going to all be millionaires. We're going to all have corner offices. It's going to be great. All you have to do is invest your money in Wall Street. And then every couple of years, they crash it a little bit and take some of it back. And it seems that they never lose, does it? And this is what's frustrating about this whole thing, because the working class of this country has been screwed for far too long. You know, my grandparents' generation, when the economy took a nosedive, their pensions were still secure. And when they retired with a set amount. They knew what they were going to get. And it was part of the three-legged stool. You had your defined benefit pension, you had your savings, you had Social Security, and they lived out their lives with dignity and respect. And a lot of our grandparents did. The problem is two of the legs they've sawed off. The defined benefit pension is gone, completely gone. Wages have been suppressed and declining for decades. So your personal savings at retirement has gone down. And what the one leg that's left, Social Security, they're still trying to destroy. So for me, I come to this point where I'm going, yes, we need a fundamental reset of what our economy is and why we have an economy. At the end of the day, an economy is not to feed the wealth class and to make the uber wealthy even wealthier, which is what we have done throughout this entire pandemic. The reality is, from the beginning of the pandemic till now, you're looking at well over $2 trillion in wealth accumulated by just a couple hundred people, while the mass of folks are struggling just to get by. Now, look, there's a little bit of wage inflation going on, which is sending the rich people crazy. Because wage inflation is bad for them. That means less for them. And it's sending the shareholders crazy, which is why they've got the Fed going, hey, you know, if wages keep going up, we might have to slam on the brakes on this inflation because we don't want wages to go up. I'm so sick of the mainstream corporate-controlled media telling us, oh, you know, all inflation's bad. The inflation's terrible. It's the end of humanity. To where whenever we hear the dreaded I word, we foam at the mouth. When the reality is we need a little wage inflation right now. We need wages to go up. We need the dignity of work to come back. And we need to tie our wage increases to our productivity again. And we do that how? Well, we do that by people being able to collectively bargain and demand those wages. Because as we have seen in this experiment, let's say neoliberalism, let's say supply-side voodoo Reaganomics, those were experiments. These were experiments. We've tried them for 40 years. We've tried neoliberal trade. We've tried supply-side voodoo Reaganomics, tax cuts for the wealthy. We've tried. They told us, hey, free trade's going to benefit everybody. Wages are going to go up. There are going to be more jobs. We'll consume more. It's going to be great. Rice and beans. The conservatives said, no, we're going to give tax breaks to the wealthy, and the wealthy will take the money because they're smart, and they know what to do with it, and they're going to create more wealth. It's going to be great for everybody. And you go, well, who have both of those things been good for? Both of those things have been really good for the wealthy. Our CEO class has gone and run overseas where they can find cheap exploitable labor. They've taken those tax cuts and they've shoveled them offshore into their tax havens. And they've bought politicians that have given them the ability to evade taxes altogether. And as we were told it was going to trickle down, it never did. The benevolence that we were told was going to be there didn't happen. And you don't have to take my word for it. There's some great imagery out there. My favorite being the graph from the end of World War II that shows the end of World War II to the middle 70s, as productivity went up, wages walked hand in hand. They were right there together. Why? Well, because 40% of the workforce was unionized and they demanded the wages. But as soon as we started saying, no, the benevolent employers, the benevolent wealthy people, they're going to take care of us. They're going to help. So we don't need those stinking unions anymore. We trust our employer. They're such good people. What's happened? Well, we've seen flatlined and declining wages while productivity continues to skyrocket. And who hoarded the productivity gains? Well, our 745 certified billionaires. They were the ones who got a good portion of it. The top 10% of the country who they're the ones who own the stocks. They're the ones who own all the decent land. They own all the big companies. They own all the shares of stock. They own this place. And our only way of continuing this experiment of self-governance is voting. And voting for people who aren't completely against us. And they're taking that. And not only are they taking it, you know, one party's completely against the working class of this country. And the other one, well, they're kind of, you know, well, you know, sometimes we're with you. It's infuriating. And look, I love what Joe Biden's doing. I love the fact that he's talking about buying stuff made in America, bringing back manufacturing, building back better, and doing it with union labor. I'm thrilled with this, providing a safety net for people so that they can exist, getting some paid family leave so we can help families get forward. Yet the sad reality, Democrats can't seem to get out of their own way. Convening the circular firing squad, shall we say, and no one more in the middle of that firing squad than Joe Manchin, who today, Joe Manchin has said he's going to be joining all 50 Republicans to back a resolution that challenges Joe Biden's vaccine mandate, which means that is going to go down. Now, here's the thing, and I've been saying this for a bit. I'm ready to go past it. I'm ready to say, fine, we're not gonna have to do this because it's only tearing us further apart. What's end up going to have to happen is, well, you know, the people who aren't vaccinated, they're the ones who are going to be dying. Capitalism is going to figure this one out. They're the ones who are going to be paying higher insurance rates. They're the ones who are probably at some point going to have to pay higher copays and stuff with things related to COVID. And I'm okay with that. That's probably how we should have gone about this from the very beginning. Because it's like any two-year-old, you tell a two-year-old, no, you can't do that. What's the first thing they're going to do? They're going to go and do something. They're going to go and they're going to have a fit and they're going to go do exactly what you told them not to. And if you tell them to do something, I got teenagers. Yeah, that's not going to. So I'm not surprised that we're in this place. Not surprised. So this is where, again, I think capitalism will decide. Manchin added that the federal government should incentivize, not penalize. And this is where I'm at. I'm with you, Joe. I'm with you. We should be incentivizing this stuff. And if that means, you know, higher insurance rates you're going to have to pay, fine. That's what it's going to mean. Because we've got to get past this pandemic somehow, and we've got to do it soon. Because all of the good stuff that we're seeing, the good gains in our economy, the things that look like they're going in the right direction, the job growth, the wage increases, our supply chain starting to come around and doing some good things there. All of this progress can completely be shut down with a massive wave of whatever's next. And the good thing, what I'm hearing about this Omicron, is it may not be as deadly. It's twice as contagious. It spreads faster. But it may not be something that is going to kill us. And that's a good thing, I think. I'm hoping there's light at the end of this tunnel to where we can get back and moving in the direction of continuing to build on our economy, to continue to help move us forward and get the stuff done that we need to get done. It's that simple for me. I'm going to take a quick break right here. When we come back, I'm going to talk to the guy who's running against Madison Cawthorn in North Carolina. I really hope this guy takes him out. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day a general strike erupted in Oakland, California. Workers, mostly women, had been on strike for a month at two downtown department stores. Teamsters honored their picket lines and refused to make deliveries. Infuriated owners of Hastings and Conn's demanded their merchandise and turned to the city for help. And on this day, police assembled early in the morning to clear the streets of picketers. They attacked strikers, forcing them off the street and setting up a perimeter of machine guns to escort scab delivery trucks through the line. One striker recalled, "I was black and blue for 6 months from their clubs." Outraged, truck drivers, bus drivers, and streetcar operators all stopped, got out of their vehicles, and joined the strikers, quickly filling downtown Oakland. By the end of the day, the city was completely shut down, 142 AFL unions called for a labor holiday in support of the strikers, and now 130,000 workers were on strike in solidarity. UAW member Stan Weir recalled that it was the bus drivers, many just returned from the war, who led the strike. The streets that night had a carnival-like atmosphere. War vets led a march to City Hall to demand the resignation of the mayor and city council for their attempts to break the strike. The general strike quickly forced the administration to stop the scab herding. But local labor leaders were divided over what some considered a near insurrection and called the strike off 54 hours later. The retail workers were left to fight on their own for another 5 months. But for a few days, workers got a taste of their own power. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, John Eastman. Remember John Eastman, the guy who wrote up that cute little memo on how Donald Trump could overthrow our elections and, you know, basically throw out a couple hundred years worth of peaceful transitions of power? Remember that? Remember that, John Eastman? Yeah, well, evidently he has said he is going to plead the fifth. Because if he opens his mouth, he will absolutely, without question, incriminate himself. And look, I expect this a lot. I expect the hearings to be a lot of Trump people coming out and sitting in the chair saying, I plead the fifth. And I'm okay with that. As long as they put it on TV and we all get to see the thieves, the liars, and cheats pleading the fifth, I am okay with that. And one of those people I would love to see on the stand, well, a couple of them, especially those folks in Congress, but one of them, that Madison Cawthorn, I want to know what he did on January 6th. He was on the stage riling people up. I want to know what he did. I'd like to see him behind bars. But more importantly, I'd like to see him thrown out of Congress altogether. And I'm hoping the good voters of the 13th Congressional District there in North Carolina will do just that. That's why I've asked the guy who's going to be running against him in the next election to come talk with us. Josh Remillard is a veteran, father, husband, Democrat in North Carolina. Impressive, and someone who I do hope is taking out Madison Cawthorn in the next election. Josh, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh man, hey, thank you so much for having me on. This is certainly an honor.
So I'm looking at this, you know, and I gotta start right from the beginning. I have no idea how this guy gets elected to, you know, any position of authority, let alone to sit in the U.S. Congress. But I understand that he ran and carpet bagged to another district to get away from you the last time. Am I getting this right?
That's correct. It was mid-November. He announced that he was moving to the newly drawn district, NC-13. Look, I mean, he said plenty of reasons in his announcement video why he was going there. You know, one was that he's trying to strengthen or bolster the conservative fighting spirit or whatever that means. But look, the in all honesty, the district that we were in previously, NC-14, had been redrawn to the point where it became more competitive and it became easier for a Democrat to win. The district that he's in, that he moved to, district 13, you know, that this was drawn so that it would be favorable to a conservative, to a Republican. So, I mean, you call a spade a spade. I mean, if it quacks like a duck and if it walks like a duck, it's got to be a duck, yeah. Right?
So now I understand you're now going after him, which good on you. Follow him wherever he's got to go. And I watched your video, which I think, and we're going to put out on social media so everyone can take a look at, touching, heartbreaking, and angering all at the same time when you think about the things that this guy has done over the last year and a half. Share with us a little bit about why you've jumped into this and why you think this is important.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'll say this just, you know, just briefly, like, I learned early that life is a fight. I mean, I was raised in the foster care system. I bounced around from family to family until my grandparents were able to adopt me. My grandfather was working for the State Department, and you know, he and my grandmother were looking forward to traveling around the world and, yeah, I guess you could say living out their golden years. But then they saw that I needed them. They found out that I needed them. And I mean, they made huge sacrifices to take me in. And look, I mean, even the jobs I held were fights. I worked on a tugboat. I worked as a piercer in a tattoo shop and as a bouncer. And then, of course, at the age of 24, that's when I enlisted in the Army to fight for my country. I was sort of milling about town in Wilmington and, started paying attention, a little bit more attention to the news. And I started seeing the death toll rise in Afghanistan and Iraq. And, I just ended up hating myself, because I'm thinking, here I am trying to clip out, coupons to go to Hardee's and get a cheap burger. And these guys are over there fighting and dying for this country. And I had like an eighth of a tank of gas in my car, and I drove straight out to the recruiter. And I said, look, man, I don't want you to sell me on anything. Put me in the infantry, put me in the fastest deploying unit you can out of basic, because that's the fight that I need to be in. I did 8 years in the Army as an infantryman and 2 combat tours in Iraq. And when I was over there, I lost battle buddies, right? When I was stationed in Germany, I met a really great guy. He was one of my best friends. And, once they cased the colors, our colors of our unit in Germany, they sent us back to the States. He went to a different unit. His unit went to Afghanistan. I stayed in the States. When I met up with him after I got out of the Army, he just wasn't the same. He wasn't the same. He had a lot of scars. He was suffering really hard from PTSD because his unit had gotten ambushed in Afghanistan, and he blamed himself for losing his battle buddies and some of his friends. And, my wife and I did everything that we could. We brought him into our house. I took him out to the VA. I tried to get him help. And in the end, his demons got the best of him. And he ended up taking his life.
And you're talking about your friend Bryce that you talk about in the video. I'll tell you, I grew up as a kid in the 1970s, watching them, the men come back from Vietnam and just being dumped into the housing project that I lived in. With broken minds, broken bodies, missing parts, drug and alcohol problems, and just dumped like trash. And it was one of these things that I had hoped we would never see again. And yet I hear stories like the one that you're telling and others, and it's heartbreaking. And I wonder why we allow that to happen. So when I hear you say this is the reason that one of the reasons I'm into this, I'm 100% behind you.
Yeah. He ended up taking his life. And you're right. The most heartbreaking, beyond him taking his life, the most heartbreaking time was, he and I were going through a Taco Bell drive-through, and he ended up just melting. He was crying, and he blamed himself for everything. And I stayed with his body until they took it away. And that's still an extremely, extremely painful memory for him. It hurts.
Can't imagine.
And all of that came rushing back on January 6th. I was sort of milling about the house, and I flipped on the news, and I was watching everything that unfold. And I remember just screaming at the TV. My wife comes walking in the house, and she's like, "What are you screaming at?" And I'm like, look what's happening to our country right now. Like, you expect this in other countries. This isn't what men and women died for to protect our country. So we had a conversation thereafter, and I said, "Look, babe, I can't live with myself if I don't get involved in this race. I fought and bled for this country. Men and women have fought and died for this country to protect our Constitution, to protect our nation's capital, our friends and our family. No, I can't stand by while this guy spits on the sacrifice of everything that every other service member has fought for. I'm honestly tired of children like Madison Cawthorn, claiming patriotism when in fact, I love this country. I love the country. You don't have to be in the military to be a patriot. But that person is not a patriot. He's a fraud. Yeah. That's just it, flat out for me.
Now, you were in the Army. You spent years as a gunner on a Humvee. When you see a picture of Madison Cawthorn and a video of him, joking that he's got a new attachment for his wheelchair, kind of imitating what you have done, what does that make you think?
Initially it makes you angry. I realize that that's just false patriotism. That's all it is. It's something to make himself look cool. It's a new toy. He doesn't respect the service and sacrifice that men and women have gone through for the past 200 years, 200 plus years of this country. He doesn't respect it. Guns to him are toys. They're accessories. It's the same as souping up your car for him. But he just drapes the flag over it. You know, I know what that's like to put another person on the end of my knife sight and to have to pull the trigger. I know what that's like. And other service members know what that's like too. And it's not fun. It's not fun in games. It's not like Call of Duty. It's not like Saving Private Ryan. It's not like those movies. This is real life. And those of us that have served and have gone through that, we take that stuff seriously.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Josh Remillard. He is running for Congress in North Carolina's 13th Congressional District. The website, joshremillard.com, if you want to check out the site. Also, maybe make a donation because all campaigns need money. If you got a question for Josh, we'd love to hear it. 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Now, you know, after the Kyle Rittenhouse decision, Madison Cawthorn came out with a little video in his car saying that we need to be armed and be dangerous. And I got to tell you, I'm a defender of the Second Amendment. I think people have the right to bear arms, but I think there are a lot of responsibilities that should come with that. But I think that messaging coming out of that moment is not only irresponsible, it should be almost criminal on a certain level. I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Look, you know, in my mind, he's immature and he's a child. That's all it is. You know, this kid has gone through life with a silver spoon in his mouth. He doesn't understand the reality, the consequences to actions, the gravity that he has in that position, being a representative. He doesn't understand it. To him, you know, it says it all, the fact that he has a comms team over having a policy team. For him, it's just about being famous. And he'll say anything that can trigger progressives, that can trigger the left, whatever. So long as he raises the hairs on people's back, he's fine, because then he's in favor with this his golden god, if you will, yeah. Donald Trump.
No, and look, you have hit on something I've been talking about for a while. Sadly, too many in the Republican Party right now it's all about reality star fame. It's all about, hey, look at me. What angle can I use to get attention? What can I do to raise my profile? They don't bring actual policy to the floor to pass legislation. They're not doing anything to make people's lives better in any way, shape, or form. It's just about them. And while, you know, on a certain level, I'm okay, go play your games, it's not moving us forward as a country. And actually, you look at what he did and others on January 6th, and this is why I'm hoping the January 6th Commission puts these people under oath and sits them down and makes them say whatever. They want to plead the fifth, fine, I want to hear that. But I want to know what these people did on January 6th. People like Madison Cawthorn.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, you know, well, I'll say this: when I took the oath of enlistment, I swore to defend the Constitution of this country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I'll tell you what, Madison Cawthorn to me has demonstrated that he's an enemy to this country, and it's imperative that he is held accountable for everything he's done since January 6th. You know, I mean, there are policy platforms that are so important that, you know, Democrats all over the country are fighting for, you know, that I care about, especially for NC-13, but in order to get those things passed, in order to progress and leave this world better for our children, we got to take someone like Madison Cawthorn. Yeah, we got to
go
down.
They got to go. Yeah. JoshRemillard.com, that's the website. Make sure you check this out. Now, we spent a bunch of time talking about just how bad he is, and he is bad. I mean, you know, fortunately, he's not smart enough, in my view, to actually have policy chops, which on a certain level, I guess, is okay. He'll have his flash in the pan, I hope. But I want to talk about what you want to see. You know, what policies are you going to move forth? It's one thing, yeah, I want him out, but I also want somebody in there who's got some ideas on how we move this country forward, because there are families that are struggling. There are kids that go to bed hungry. There are veterans who go to bed homeless. These are real things that need to be addressed. How do you go about that?
That's exactly right. You know, and I'll start off by saying, you know, when I got out of the Army, you know, when my tours were up, I left the Army, but the Army didn't leave me. You know, there was so much work to do back home. So I engaged. I engaged with the community. And, you know, I volunteered with Team Rubicon. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with who that organization or what that organization is, but they train veterans on how to respond to natural disaster and then to aid in natural disaster relief. So they actually got my wildland firefighter certification and my damage assessment certification. And then they sent me off to Florida after Hurricane Michael to aid in disaster relief. So, you know, I've always believed that if anyone says that they want to represent a community, lead a community, advocate for community, whatever the case is, then you need to be willing to get down on the ground with that community and lend yourself to that community.
Yep.
So for me, I want to first and foremost make sure that, my brothers and sisters in arms are taken care of, that you know that the VA is strengthened, that the hospitals, that the VA hospitals are improved, you know, because they need to be improved at least to the same age as the rest of the hospitals out there.
Well, as I understand, they're like 50,000 people short because the last administration did not hire anybody. So we've got some real problems on that vein. And you know, the reality is they've allowed that to languish. He took a lot of credit for stuff he didn't do. But at the end of it, you were still 50,000 employees short at a time when the need is at its height. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, what's that issue that Josh Remillard goes, now this is it. This is the important issue. Is it the veterans issue? Is it, you know, healthcare? Is it labor rights? What is Josh Remillard's hill that policy wise he dies on?
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, veterans issues are very important. But, you know, the other thing, too, that I think that will help out veterans is strengthening our economy, because once we get out of the military, we become blue collar workers. Right. We get back into the working environment and we start working again. So I want to continue strengthening our economy. I want to continue bringing jobs back to NC-13, to North Carolina. I think the infrastructure bill is a fantastic approach to help and rebuild our infrastructure, helping to secure our supply lines and helping to secure the middle class.
Is most certainly something that we need to do. And I'm grateful we got that. I'm hoping we get something on the Build Back Better plan. And we do that with union labor and with good, solid union wage jobs for folks to be able to take care of their families. Josh, I appreciate the time. I wish you the best. I want you to come back early and often as this campaign heats up. I wish you the best. And again, I hope you come back.
Thank you so much for having me on. It certainly means a lot.
Good stuff. Appreciate it. Josh Remillard. Make sure you check out the website, joshremillard.com. We'll get links out on social media on how you can do that. And look, at the end of the day, the reality is Madison Cawthorn has to go. This is one of those moments where, sadly, we have let people into our halls of power who are, well, they are not. They don't live up to the expectations and the needs that we should have. This is where I'm frustrated. I look at him, I look at Boebert, I look at Marjorie Taylor Greene, I look at these people who have nothing but contempt and disrespect for our halls of power and bring nothing to the table. And yet there they are causing all this friction, all this chaos, and getting nothing done. And while nothing gets done, what happens? We still have people who suffer. We still have families who are struggling. We still have kids who go to bed hungry. We still have veterans who go to bed homeless. And we have people like Josh's friend, Bryce, who not getting the help that they need and suffering with the demons that they have. And this is not who we are. So make sure you check out the website, joshremillard.com. We'll get links out on social media. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1833. That was the day that the Oberlin Collegiate Institute was founded in North Central Ohio. Today, it's known as Oberlin College. The college was the project of two Presbyterian ministers, John J. Seifert and Philo Stewart. Their goal was to form a college based on Christian principles. In the early days, tuition was free and students were expected to give their labor to help sustain the school and community. The college motto, Learning and Labor, harkens back to that time. From early on, the college was different than many other institutions of higher learning of its day. In 1835, Oberlin became the first predominantly white college to admit black male students. 2 years later, Oberlin broke new ground again, letting in women and becoming the first co-ed college in the nation. By opening its doors to black and women enrollees, Oberlin gave these students a chance to study and pursue careers that might otherwise have been closed to them. By the turn of the 20th century, one-third of all black professionals in the United States had graduated from Oberlin. In 1862, Mary Jane Patterson became the first African-American woman to earn her bachelorette degree from Oberlin. She became a teacher and principal. Another black graduate, John Mercer Langston, would become the first black lawyer in Ohio and first black congressman to represent Virginia in Washington, D.C. Oberlin College was also known for its stance supporting the abolition of slavery and later supporting civil rights. The school was a stop on the Underground Railroad, which helped enslaved people escape into freedom to Canada. And to this day, the Oberlin community is still on the cutting edge of opportunity and change. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So there may be Rice Krispies for Christmas after all. Yep, it may happen. It may happen. It's not sure yet, but there may be Rice Krispies for Christmas, and I'll tell you why. Evidently, there has been a tentative agreement between the BCTGM, the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco, and Grain Millers Union that represents the Kellogg's workers and Kellogg's Incorporated. They got a 3% raise, I guess. Cost of living adjustments in the second through the fifth year, not bad. Doing something on the two-tier wage system, I'm not sure that that's going to be enough, but we'll see how the vote turns out. I understand that, you know, the next couple of weeks we should get some voting information. And that's why I say there may be Rice Krispies for Christmas, because after all, Kellogg does make Frosted Flakes and Rice Krispies. And as I've been pointing out on my social media, they've been sending the scab boxes out. So make sure you're checking for your union label. And look, it is... Well, it's Strikesmas now. We went through Striketober and then Strikesgiving and now Strikesmas. And that is continuing on. And, well, sadly, we see this strike going on out in what is Western Pennsylvania. Workers at Erie Strayer have been off, I guess, since October 4th. And from what I'm reading, you know, it doesn't even seem like the company wants to negotiate. I'm here to share some thoughts on what's going on there. I have asked Tracy Cutright to come talk with us. Tracy's the vice president, business rep for Ironworkers, regional shop, local number 851 of the Ironworkers. Tracy, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick, and thanks for having me.
That is quite a mouthful to get to local 851.
Isn't it?
but hey, good things. Yeah. There may be Rice Krispies for Christmas. That's a good thing, right?
Absolutely. Yes. I hope they get back to work.
So let's hope that their success and the success of John Deere and other places that we've seen trickles and hits you guys, because you guys have been out since October 4th. This is a fairly lengthy strike.
Yeah, we just basically finished week 10. So we've been out. We went out October 4th, and then we weren't even aware of what was going on the rest of the country with like John Deere or Kellogg or whatever, but it was just like bam, bam, bam. And we're just a little shop local and kind of got caught up in this whirlwind.
Yeah, now, as I've been reading through this, this doesn't sound like a lot. Your requests, your demands don't seem all that that strenuous. How is it that we're in this situation? I'm curious. I mean, because it didn't seem like you guys were asking for much.
No, we're not asking for much. It's this company. It's all about power. It's what, you know, we wanted a dental plan. These men, long before I was representing them, wanted a dental plan for the last two contracts prior to this one. They wanted a dental plan. And, you know, the adage is, what you didn't get last time, you ask for at the next table. And so we put dental. And the company's response is, we've never had dental and you're never getting dental. I mean, they drew the line in the sand basically the first full day of negotiations.
And that's one of those things that, you know, I've been in negotiations like this in the past. That's one of those things that isn't even all that costly in the grand scheme of things. And it's something as an employer, wouldn't you want to extend to your workforce to keep them and keep them happy and to keep them around? It just seems like, I don't know, it would seem like good business to extend that kind of a benefit. What doesn't it? I mean, am I wrong?
You would think that it would actually help them recruit and retain. And we've made that argument at the table time and time again. It's like you need something to draw these workers in. And because they have a pretty good turnover because of their business model of working guys 7 days a week and treating them very poorly. So it's like you need this. And as you go on Indeed all through Erie, you know, all these jobs, they're offering dental, eye. Something that the Erie Strayer guys don't have. And it is not very costly.
Now, I hear that in a lot of places where they're talking about the hours, because you brought up hours working 7 days a week and this kind of, you know, I remember reading in multiple books and places that labor fought for the 8-hour day. Labor fought for the 40-hour work week. And yet I keep hearing all of these places that are working 6-7 days a week, 14 hours a day, 12 hours a day, because you've got these employers who have just been abusing them. And are we at a moment, Tracy, where people have said, you know what, yeah, I would have put up with it the year before last, but, you know, now not so much?
Absolutely. Now, the overtime is not mandatory at Erie Strayer. I just get that straight. It's not. But in order to get the extras, you know, because of the wages and stuff in the Erie area, to get the extras, they're sort of forced into working this overtime. You know, the time and a half on Saturdays, the double time on Sundays. And it's just their business model, the company's business model, because of their production. You know, these guys are, how I want to put it, they're specialized. You know, there's a lot of bottlenecks in that production of those mixers. So they need these guys. They're not cross-trained. One guy works on this particular part and he passes it down the line. And the workers are, that's enough. As enough is enough. Ever since I've been representing these guys, they've been talking about this contract to me because they knew it was coming up. And you know, we're here to fight for them. That's what they want. We work for them.
No, ultimately it was their decision. And look, no one.
Yes.
You know, I've been on strike before as a worker, and I know what it's like. I know the sacrifice that comes with it. And I know the challenges. Look, you know, no one wants to lose their job. Nobody wants to lose a paycheck. But sometimes you get pushed to that point to where there's no going back, and there's nowhere else to go. And it sounds like the company kind of forced you into this by not addressing your main concerns.
Absolutely. It just felt like they were forcing us through a cattle chute all through the negotiations. Like I said, we started March 12th with this contract. We exchanged proposals on March 12th. And we, you know, we had a lot of language stuff that we would pull something off the table. And it was like playing a game of Plinko. They would take a nickel and it would drop down through there and fall in one of these 5 years. And when we went on strike, they were offering zero in the first year. And 5 cents in the second year, like 10 cents in the third year. And we're in 6% inflation land, you know, and this is what they were doing. And the guys, and every time we would have a meeting after every bargaining session, and it just made these guys resolve more, you know, more resolved. They knew it was coming. They worked for him. Someone wanted a guy on the line 47 years with this company.
Wow.
You know?
So I asked the same question of everyone. When a scenario like this pops up, how much of this is just hardball, you know, negotiating tactics, or they want a strike so that they can end up breaking the union, hoping that more people will cross the line and end up getting rid of the union altogether?
Yeah, I guess we'll never know unless there's a phantom email or something. But it does seem that way, Rick. It absolutely seems like they're trying to break those guys' spirit and then eventually break the union. But that's not happening. My guys are very strong. We're a small group, but they're out there every day, you know, in the rain and the snow and the mud. They don't care. They're fighting for, you know, and one of the guys, he's been there 47 years. He could retire. He said, I'm on this line, not for myself, but for the guys that are coming in the door after me. And I have to take my hats off to them. They are union strong.
No, and that's a great message to hear, because I've been hearing that a lot lately. There had been a period of, hey, I'm getting what I can get for me now. Now we're starting to see people, you know, going, no, I want to leave something for my kids, especially, you know, like the Kellogg strike. You know, they want to get rid of these two-tier wage systems so that, you know, the next generation, they can have a good quality, family-sustaining, union wage job to raise their families and help support their future. That's good to hear. I mean, that is great to hear that we're coming around back to that.
Yes. For years, you know, and I've seen some of your clips and stuff. You talked about the Kellogg's with the two-tier, you know, which is killing the unborn or something, your phrase you used. And that's exactly right. You had the two-tier wages. You've seen two-tier vacation schedules. And that's not what these guys want. They want their successors to be in a very good union environment.
Now, one of the things that I give you credit for, Tracy, and your local credit for is you have made the social media rounds. You seem to be doing a really good job of doing what has to be done, and that's engaging the community and bringing people in. I see on your website that you got responses from the governor, Tom Wolf. You got responses from my friend John Fetterman, from my friend Sarah Nelson came out, and you had all of these folks, you know, bringing attention to this, which I think is really important. What kind of response are you getting from folks outside?
Well, outside of the political specter, the city of Erie. You know, like I said, I represent four shops in Erie, as well as in Ohio and in Pittsburgh area. But that city of Erie, I said, I had no idea the outpouring of support we would get from just the average citizen. It is nothing. We'll be on the line, and they'll just stop, open up their trunk, and start handing cases of water, pizzas, donuts, sandwiches. It's just incredible. But I just like to touch on it. Not only is it our local, but it's our international support we've got on this. So they're actually driving our media campaign and stuff, and they're doing an excellent job.
It's really important.
I appreciate you saying that, because I'm impressed with them.
No, I mean, we've got to engage the community. There's an education process that goes with this. The reason I think it's so important that you guys are doing this is there's a community education process that's been lost. Generations past understood what a strike was. They understood what a lockout was. They understood why people were on the picket line. Now today, it's left up to the corporate media to tell them what it is instead of them knowing it viscerally. Our hope is, you know, by this stuff, by what you're doing and what we do, the little program we do here, is to educate folks on, you know, why someone's out on the picket line. And one of the things that I've been pushing for right now is this Adopt a Striker program. Go out and walk on the picket line with somebody. Just go out and listen. Take the master's class in working class economics and go listen and find out why they're there, the struggles, the trials, the tribulations, and how profitable these companies really are. So, again, find a strike in your neighborhood. You can go to aflcio.org/strike and they will find you a place. But again, I go back to this because the community is vitally important in putting pressure on companies like this, because, you know, ultimately the community buys their products.
Yes. Yeah. And like you said, Adopt a Striker, we've had people just show up. It's sort of a, industrial / residential community, and we've had the neighbors just come over and ask for a sign that they could stand there with us. It's just heartwarming,
and that's what's important, bringing those folks together. Now I understand this Erie Strayer company, that they actually took some PPP money back during the pandemic. Am I getting this right? Because from what I understand, this is a very profitable company. They've gotten, you know, this money from the federal government. Did it? I'm guessing it didn't trickle down, did it?
No. Unlike many of the shops during the initial, when the Governor Wolf declared the emergency, they declared our guys essential for day one, because they make concrete batch plants, and we need this for, you know, what soon to be infrastructure bill, but, you know, they needed this. And so they were essential workers. They worked, like I said, 7 days a week. They did not shut the doors until we went on strike, 7 days a week. And they just basically took that $1.3 million and took it from their left pocket and put it in the right pocket. And it was like a welfare check to them.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, and you brought up the infrastructure bill, which I know your union and others are thrilled that we finally got through, because it's going to mean lots of work for your members. It's going to mean lots of work for this Erie Strayer company, and it's going to mean a lot of prevailing wage work, which means, you know, as this money comes flowing through, this company's going to be even more profitable. So it seems to me that it would be, I don't know, forward looking to want to keep your valuable employees and give them a little something. And again, I look at what you're asking for. It isn't a lot.
No, it's not. And you would think that, I mean, the common man would think that they would want to settle this strike, get these guys back to work, so that, when their contracts come in for, the runways, they need the mixers, the dual mixers and stuff for, these bridges that they're going to pour. You would think that they would want to bring our guys back to work, but it's all about power, Rick. They want to dictate to the union, you're going to get a quarter an hour, which would be like 1.3%. That was their recent offer, was five quarters. They want a 5-year deal for five quarters with nothing else, no dental. And it's ridiculous. 1.3, and we're in 6% inflation. They want them to work for less than they did last year.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. And again, you look at this, and it's, as you pointed out, the inflation's going up, wages are going up everywhere. It almost sounds like they don't want to keep their people, which is, from what you've said, it's a specialized gig. You would think that you'd want to keep them.
Yeah, they're not plug and play. I mean, the management during negotiations, they keep, I don't know who they're trying to fool, but they try to act like they could just go get any Joe Blow off the street and bring him in and put that welding rod in their hand and put that thing together or assemble it. And that's not, it takes years to get up to speed on these
now,
projects.
Now, let me ask you this, because, it sounds like they're stuck in 2019. Because this sounds like something in 2019, and I don't know your organization or what your members would have put up with in 2019, but would this have flown in 2019? Would you have gotten this contract through? Or is it now the people are going, no, we're not taking that kind of mentality that's, here's a quarter and shut up and go away. The timing, I'm asking is, is that the important part here?
No. Not with this group right here. I mean, yes, they were seeing the changes in the prices and stuff, but well before 2019, they knew what they were wanting going into this contract, and they would not have taken a quarter in 2019, sir.
So, last question I got for you: what can we do to help? How can people help? This, you guys have been out on strike since October 4th. You've been negotiating since March, which is just ridiculous. What can folks do to help? What can we do to help push this?
Yeah, Yeah, it's getting cold out there. So if they go to our website, eriestrayer.com, there's a link to a GoFundMe page. 100% of that money goes to the guys who have for the Christmas, for, just incidentals for the families and stuff like that. We're trying to maybe get some insurance money. We're trying to work with the state to try to get some insurance because, we didn't touch on it. But they did turn off the insurance, and I know I'm going to run long with you, but they illegally cut off the insurance on day one of the strike, which was against the law and against the contract. But, you know how it goes.
Any negotiations going on currently?
Pardon?
Any negotiations going on currently?
We negotiated this week. That's where we finally got them up to a quarter a year, and then we're going to negotiate again on the 17th.
Well, I wish you the best. I hope the next negotiation, they wake up. I'm hoping people will put some pressure on them. Folks in the community, maybe call, email, do the social media stuff, all of that. But I hope you guys get back to work soon. One day longer, brother. I appreciate your time.
One day stronger. Thank you.
There you go. Good stuff. Tracy Cuthright, make sure you check out the website that they have, ErieStrayerStrike.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can check that out. Also, their website, ironworkers851.org. We'll get those out. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1916. That was the day that seven Australian members of the Industrial Workers of the World were sentenced to 15 years in prison for their anti-war efforts during World War I. Other IWW members were sentenced to as many as 5 and 10 years each. The IWW had led the way in protesting the use of the draft, or what was called conscription, during World War I. On August 10, 1914, the front page of the Australian IWW newspaper, Direct Action, had declared war. For what? For the workers and their dependents, death, starvation, poverty, and untold misery. For the capitalist class, gold, stained with the blood of millions, riotous luxury, banquets of jubilation over the graves of their dupes and slaves. An Australian Wobbly leader, Tom Barker, had urged, "Let those who own Australia do the fighting. Put the wealthiest in the front ranks. The middle class next. Follow these with politicians, lawyers, sky pilots, and judges. Answer the declaration of war with a call for a general strike." Barker was arrested and jailed more than once for his stance on the war. In 1916, Australians had grown increasingly weary of the fighting. They voted no in a referendum on the continued use of conscription. That September 1916, the government raided IWW offices and arrested key leaders. The leaders were sentenced to long prison terms. 9 months later, the IWW was outlawed in Australia. The membership rolls were made available to employers who blacklisted anyone on the lists. Continued involvement in the IWW could result in 6 months hard labor in the work camps. This government oppression took a sharp toll on the union. But to its credit, the IWW still exists in Australia to this day.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.